Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Ascending to the high seat, Dogen Zenji said, Zen Master Hogen studied with Keshin Zenji. And once Keshin Zenji asked him, Joseph, where do you go? And Hogen said, I am making pilgrimage aimlessly. And Keshin said, well, what is the matter of your pilgrimage? And Hogen said, I don't know. And Keshin said, not knowing is the most intimate. And Hogen suddenly attained great enlightenment. Should be so simple. There are around and about today, I think, some misconceptions about Zen. Zen is just Zen. People ask you what Zen is. Zen is Zen. Other people think this is crazy. You know, somebody once told me that they had seen a thing on TV about Japan, and this man went around asking people that he met on the street what is Zen. And somebody said, well, Zen is Zen. And somebody else answered, well, Zen is you. Or Zen is me. Or I don't know. So, of course, this person decided that Zen couldn't be very worthwhile because even the people in Japan didn't know what it was. And yet they were pretty good answers if you know something about Zen. Yeah. There is nothing comparable to it. It's in a class all by itself. It is a very unique religion. It is very unique in the sense that it is the most ordinary. We look for the ordinary. And yet, at the same time, it is one of the most extraordinary phenomena that has ever happened to human consciousness. It is the acceptance of this ordinary living with a total heart. Not desiring some other world, some supramundane or supramental world. So they say, you know, it is the acceptance of this shore, this ordinary shore, ordinary living. And it is through the acceptance of this shore that the other shore, so to speak, you know, this shore is transformed into the other shore. And so we have the saying that nirvana is samsara and samsara is nirvana. If you can see the truth, you see it here. Where else are you going to find it? Now, the term nirvana is usually compared with a Christian heaven. So heaven is on earth. Well, Jesus said that too, you know. Heaven is on earth. Why stand ye gazing? Nirvana, the term nirvana, as we all know, means blown out. Now, what is blown out? What is blown out? You blow out a candle flame, huh? It's blown out. There's still a candle. Nirvana, we speak of as being the other shore, or the shore of wisdom. And samsara, this shore, is a life of birth and death. And we have to understand both. And they're not far away. Both are with you now. And you know, our chant that we do, before we sit, the Hanya Haramita Shingyo, that sutra, we do a short version of it, is translated something like this. Thus, Sariputra, all things have the character of emptiness. They have no beginning, no end. They are faultless and not faultless. They are not perfect and not imperfect. Therefore, O Sariputra, here in this emptiness, there is no form, no perception, no name, no concepts, no knowledge. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No form, no sound, no smell, no taste, excuse me, no touch, no objects. There is no knowledge, no ignorance, no destruction of ignorance. There is no decay nor death. There are no four truths. Now, the four noble truths, that all is suffering or pain. There is an origin of suffering. There is a stoppage of suffering. And there is a path of stopping the suffering. That's the Four Noble Truths. There is no knowledge of nirvana, no attaining of it, no not obtaining of it. Therefore, O Sariputra, as there is no obtaining of nirvana, a man who has approached the Hanyaharamita of the Bodhisattvas dwells unimpeded in consciousness. When the impediments of consciousness are annihilated, then he becomes free of all fear, is beyond the reach of change, enjoying the final nirvana. When he has reached that stage of perfect enlightenment, we say, Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, perfect enlightenment, the final nirvana. That's what you're chanting all the time. No ear, no sound, no touch, no object. And then you sit there with your thinking. You know, and as we go through such a translation, people hearing it for the first time, you know, they criticize Zen. Zen advocates a philosophy of pure negation. You negate everything. And nothing is further from the truth. And it says all is emptiness, and there's no knowledge, no ignorance, no destruction of ignorance, no perception, no name, no concepts, no knowledge. Zen simply aims at the grasping of the very center, the fact at the center, which is the very core of life. in order to get to this core, which is within you. We go through a series of negations. And so it is called the via negativa. You know, it is simply not affirming. We affirm all the time, this is a candle. That's an affirmation. It is what it is. It is a candle. What is it? Reality, we're going to call it that, or nirvana, or truth, is not this. And yet it is this. It is not that. And yet it is that. But this via negativa, just to sit there and negate everything, is not really the spirit of Zen. One negates in order not to cling to something so that you can be free. We have this, in the Western world, this Aristotelian logic that we follow. A cannot be B. This is an object, therefore it cannot be reality. A cannot be B. A is A. It's all it can ever be. It's a candle. Therefore, it is a candle. We have a dualistic way of thinking. And it is this kind of thinking that must be cut to the root by using what is called this via negativa or this negation. So we negate. There's a thought goes by. That's not my thought. And another thought goes by, well, that's not my thought either. And here this mood arises, I look at it, well, that's not really me. So that's not my mood. So then what's left after all these denials? One denies everything down to the very roots, to the very core. What is left? Oh, I'm going to have nothing. So if a little monk comes to a roshi and asks a question, you know, like this, what's left if I deny everything? You know? It's very apt that this roshi may give him a slap in the face. Which says in effect, you know, you fool, you know, what is this? Now, the slap is not an excuse to get away from the situation, and it is not ill-breeding, you know. When you can grasp the real spirit of this thing, in its pure form, Zen is Zen, then we can see what a real thing a slap in the face is, or a twist of the nose. Ouch! But you're very aware of yourself. In that instance, you're very aware of yourself. It's just a living fact. Just experience. A simple experience. See, all the peace and all the quietness and all the simplicity and all the so-called emptiness, you know, that you can desire is in the middle of this very active life. It's in the center of all of our mental structuring. And Zen, at the very core, is in that slap in the face, or the nose. Now, in a manner of speaking, if we want to know, we are forced to this negation, you know, because of our ignorance. And they say this ignorance clings to the mind like wet clothes clings to the body. Yeah. If we want to get to the point, you know, to really arrive at the point, we must be able to perceive, to see, you know, from the point where consciousness is not identified with anything. Or sometimes they put it, where consciousness is not yet awakened. Usually we think of awakened consciousness as I, but when it is not I, what is it? No I, no thing. And in that state where consciousness is not identified, see, it is absorbed in its own identity, in its own serenity, in its own emptiness. So all of the negations lead to an absolute affirmation. See? And this is something that our everyday language cannot convey. Zen, in its negations, you know, at the same time it negates, if you will look, it is always holding up before us something which is right before our eyes, right in front of our nose. And if we don't pick it up, it's our own fault. There are those people whose mental vision is clouded by ignorance, pass it by and refuse to look at it. And to these kind of people, this kind of person, Zen then is just nihilistic. It just shook, 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 until everything is empty and it's zero. Do you know that Christian Science does the same thing? It's zero. Even an atom is a zero. It doesn't really exist except as an object. Yeah. But nihilism in Zen is only because they miss the point. They can't pick it up. And now when Obaku, who was Rinzai's master, Dogen in this thing is Soto Zen. Rinzai is Rinzai Zen. The whole sect thing was named after him. And he was in the little sanctuary, the little sanctuary where they have the Buddha shrine. And he's paying homage, reverence to the Buddha. Just, you know. And one of the monks approached him, must have been a very new monk. And he says to him, but Zen says not to seek it. Now, it being realization or attainment, liberation, freedom. Not to seek it through the Buddha, nor through the Dharma, nor through the Sangha. Why do you bow to the Buddha as if wishing to get something by this pious act? I do not seek it, said Obaku, through the Buddha, nor through the Dharma, nor through the Sangha. I just go on doing this act of piety and reverence. And this little disciple grunted, what's the use of looking so sanctimonious? And the master gave him a slap in the face, you know? Whereupon this little monk said, well, how rude you are. And Ubako just looked at him and he said, do you know where you are? Here, I have no time to consider for your sake what rudeness or politeness means. And he gave him another slap. Rudeness and politeness. You know, if you're clinging to that, you're not going to see the truth. And if you look at that little anecdote, now whether it was true or not is all beside the point, huh? The perceptive person will see in this attitude of Obaku's that there is something that he really wants to convey to this little monk. Even though he's very brusque with him, he is trying to tell him something in that. Outwardly, this man is very forbidding. You know, I don't know that I would have wanted to be with him or not. You know, he was very brusque. And yet, you know, in this, at the same time, he's very giving. And this is the point that must be comprehended if one's going to understand Zen at all. So Zen may say, no mind. They use the term frequently, no mind, there's no mind. Drop the thinking, you know. But it doesn't mean to leave the mind blank as if it there was nothing. You know, that would be intellectual suicide. There is in Zen something, and that something is free. It's something that knows no limitation. And the mind is a living fact. Living. It's not just empty space. It's not just nothing, you know. It is living, vibrant, and radiant. Yeah. To come into contact with this livingness, this mind, or no mind, huh? No thinking mind. To take hold of it in every phase of life. If you're sitting, if you're walking, if you're eating, if you're sleeping, whatever. That is the aim of Zen discipline. To be in this mind. They put it very well, St. Paul did. Let that mind be in you which was in Christ Jesus our Lord. That mind, in every phase of living, then that shore becomes this shore. Yeah. Now, the Roshi Nanzen, long, long time ago, after, you know, Nanzenji. Yeah, Nanzenji is the temple for Nanzen. He was asked once by Hyakujo if there was anything that he did not talk about to others. Oh, and this master answered, Nanzen answered, well, yes, there is. Oh, what is this something that you don't talk about? It's not the Buddha. It's not the mind. It's not a thing. See, that kind of a negation asserts itself into something is there. It just, it's not the Buddha, and it's not the mind. It's not a thing. Well, then what's left? Yeah. So the little monk, he comes to Joshu, and he says, well, now, what would you say if I came into you and said I had nothing? He thinks he's pretty smart. He dropped everything, I have nothing. You know, and Joshu answers, fling it to the ground. And the monk, you know, he's affronted. I said I had nothing. Now what am I going to let go of? What should I fling to the ground? I have got nothing. Well, if so, carry it away. Oh, that explains so much, you know. To reach where you want to go, in yourself. Even the idea of having nothing has got to be done away with. I have got nothing. Oh, I'm so great. I've got nothing. You see, this is ridiculous. For the Buddha's sake, Buddha is given up. You know, so comes the phrase, you know, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Because what you've got by the tail is probably one of your own hallucinations. So kill it. Yeah. As long as one talks about nothingness and emptiness, or absolute, or universality, or, you know, all these nice terms, huh? One is very far away. The only way to be saved is to throw yourself into a bottomless pit, an abyss, huh? Yeah, and that's no easy task. You know the little story of this man that was an atheist. And he was walking along in the mountains along a cliff, and he slipped and he fell over the edge. And as he plunged down, you know, he managed to grab the branch of a little tree. And sometimes the story says, you know, a little strawberry twig with two strawberries there. He wanted to eat the strawberries. How could he eat the strawberries? He couldn't eat the strawberries without letting go. That's one version of it. Anyway, in this particular story, there is this little tree growing in the crevice on the rock. And you know, he grabs this thing and he's hanging there and he's swaying in the cold wind. And he realized how helpless his position was. How helpless is our position? Way down there, and way down there, there are these jagged boulders. And there is absolutely no way he can climb up. It is this sheer. And he's hanging there, and of course, you know how we are. Little by little, the grip begins to weaken. You can't hang on there forever. The muscles give out. They become fatigued, just like the mind becomes fatigued. Well, he thought, only God can save me now. Yeah, I've never believed in God, but you know, I could be wrong. What have I got to lose? So he calls out, God, if you exist, save me, and I will believe in you. You know, and there wasn't any answer. So he called out again, please, God, please. I have never believed in you, but if you will save me now, I will believe in you forever. And all of a sudden, this voice boomed down from out of the clouds. Oh, no, you won't. I know your kind. Yeah. And the man was so surprised, he almost let go, you know. Please, God, you're wrong. I really mean it. I will believe, you know. Oh, no, you won't. That's what they all say. Yeah. And the man pleaded and he argued with his voice, and finally God says, all right, I'll save you. Let go of the branch. Yeah, yeah. Let go of the branch, this man exclaims. You think I'm crazy? Huh? Yeah. But if he had, he would have found that the other shore, the shore of wisdom or pranya, huh, is this shore. And this very body, Buddha. Yeah. This very earth, the lotus paradise. See, Hakuin had done just that. Yeah. See, this is the greatness of Zen. It transforms all of this mundane into the sacred. Everything becomes holy. There is reverence for everything. And in that, you see, it is tremendously extraordinary. Because in this way, in this manner, life has not been approached before. In this way, life has not been respected before. In this way, life has not been reverenced before. That suddenly everything here is holy. Including you. Including your body. And now, you know, people want to reach paradise again. You never left it. You just got clouded over. the teachings of Lao Tzu and the teachings of the Buddha, you know, have merged into Zen. It holds them both, it uses them both. And sometimes there's more emphasis on Lao Tzu, on Taoism, and sometimes there's more emphasis on Buddhism. And so we say, Zen being the child of this marriage transcends both. See, it transcends both the Indian and the Chinese genius. The essence of the teaching of both have merged into this one stream, which is direct from the source. Sometimes, unless you mishmash it up. Yeah. But if you understand Zen, both teachings, Taoism and Buddhism, are 2,500 years old. And yet Zen lives in this present, now. No. It is the finger that is always pointing to now. Now you are alive. Now you are awake. Now you do what you do. It points a finger at how to get out of the past, which isn't anymore. How not to get involved in the future, which is not yet. But just to be rooted, to be centered, you know, with yourself. How easy then to have a relationship? How easy then to cope? Yeah. Now, there is a point also I think we ought to talk about it for a minute. Zen Roshis do not tell the truth. You know, it's like what I said a few minutes ago. What is this one thing that Nansen didn't talk about? It's not the Buddha. It's not the mind. It's not a thing. Even if they wanted to, they couldn't. I've told you many things in all these many years, but I cannot tell you the truth because the truth can't be told. Yeah? I can point, I can indicate, I can say, don't go that way, go this way. You know, look there, you know. I can try to provoke it in you. I can try to challenge you to look. But I cannot give you God. I cannot give you Nirvana. I cannot give you this lotus land. In the first place, you already have it. It is intrinsic in your very nature. But what the words represent, you must experience, and then you know. I mean, it's like a little kid, you know. He plays around in the kitchen, and he runs to the stove, and he sees a fire burning. It's a gas stove, you know. Or the fireplace, and there's a fire going, and it looks pretty to him, and so he wants to grab it. Mama says, mm-mm, that's hot. You will get burned. Stay out of it. And he sits back, and he looks at it, and he looks at it, and it's pretty, and he wants it, you know. So she leaves the room for a minute, and what do you know? He experiences what fire is. And that's the only way he's ever going to know. It's the only way you know what love is. It's through yourself. I can sit here and tell you about love until I'm blue in the face. And maybe till you're red in the face. There is in the New Testament the story of Lazarus. You know, about his death and his resurrection. Lazarus dies. He's a devotee of Jesus. But Jesus is away. And he's far enough away so that it's 2 days before the runner can catch up with him to tell him about Lazarus is dead. You know? And he comes immediately. But it takes him 2 days to get back to where Lazarus is. 4 days. He reaches there, and Mary and Martha are standing there in front of this cave. Now, these two women have waited for him. They really trusted Jesus. They waited for him to come. They didn't do anything about Lazarus. They waited. And in the Jewish tradition, I understand that they are embalmed or whatever immediately. Immediately. But here now is Lazarus 4 days in this cave. And the people in the village, you know, in the little town there, are laughing at these two women. These two women they're saying are stupid, keeping a corpse in a cave. And they watch these women guarding this cave. See? And of course, after 4 days, why, there's an aroma coming from the cave. The body is deteriorating. We smell. Yeah, it's a fact of life. And these people in the town are saying, but you fools, you know, Jesus can't do anything. When one is dead, one is dead. This thus saith the villagers. And Jesus comes, and he walks up to the cave. He doesn't go into the cave. He just walks up to the cave. And he stands outside, and he calls, Lazarus! And so the people begin to gather. This man must be crazy. You know, what's he doing? The man in there is dead. Completely unperturbed. He pays him no attention, you know. Jesus shouts again and again, Lazarus, come out! Come out! You know. And the villagers are in for a really great surprise. Lazarus walks out of the cave. Yeah. And he's shaken, you know, he's shocked, you know, as if he were just awakened out of a great slumber. He can't believe himself what has happened. You know, he doesn't even understand. Why was he in the cave? Now, whether Lazarus was really dead or not is beside the point. Whether Jesus was capable of raising the dead or not is also beside the point at this moment. We are all in the same position as Lazarus. We're living in a dark cave, you know, dark upon dark treading. Yeah? We are all deteriorating. That's why we use so many deodorants. I guess. Mouthwash and everything else. Hairspray. Smell good. Perfume. Smell good. You know, death is not something that comes upon us suddenly one day. We die a little every day. It's a long process. It takes 70, 80, 90 years. Maybe someday 150 years. Who knows, huh? We die a little every day. Each moment something in us dies. But you know, we're not aware of it. No. We go on acting as if we were totally alive. And maybe we've never even been totally alive after we were the age of 2. The little Eric back there, he's totally alive. He can't think yet. See, we go around acting as if we knew what life was all about. And all we know about is our little situations, you know, that we have our concepts about. And so the concepts become our reality. You know? All a teacher can do is shout, Lazarus, come out. So, come out. Come on, wake up. You know, it's like trying to trigger a process in you. Truth, you are. You are. It's only that this dust has gathered, this cloud has gathered, and you need a bath. You need a shower. You know, you wash away some of the dust, you know. Baptism. Yeah. And when the dust is gone, it's like the master, one of the Roshis said, All the teachings of the sages, all the teachings of the saints, all the teachings of the masters, of the patriarchs, have expounded no more than this. They are all simply commentaries of your sudden cry of this. See, I ought to stand up here and just say, all this, huh? All this? Would you understand? All this? So there is an emphasis in Zen on not knowing. So it's called the via negativa. And it does not mean that it emphasizes stupidity or ignorance. Ignorance, stupidity, stupid ignorance. Sometimes ignorance I refer to as something else. But this particular moment, it's, you know, not knowing. It's a state of innocence. But an ignorant man is one who ignores. That's stupid ignorance. Ignores. It's the same root, huh? An ignorant person goes on ignoring something essential. And I have seen it over and over and over again. Even those who think, I have got something, they have ignored what was essential. A person may know all about heaven and about hell. He may know about God, but he knows nothing about himself. Who he is, what this consciousness is. He is ignorant because he is ignoring the most fundamental. We know, St. John said, every man cometh into this world as the light. The light lighteth every man that cometh into this world. This is fundamental. How long are you going to ignore it? We cannot ignore ourselves and know. Mind can be knowledgeable, or it can be knowing. These are two aspects of the same mind. Knowledge is introduced to the mind after the physical birth. Knowing, the noesis, the noetic quality, is always present, even before you were born. It is like the heart knowing how to beat. Or a seed knowing how to sprout. Or like a flower knowing how to bloom. Or like a baby knowing how to grow. A fish knowing how to swim. Fish doesn't have to go to school and get a BA and an MA and a PhD and become a better and better and better swimmer. He knows. He knows how to swim. That's the state of a fish. He doesn't know that he knows. You're supposed to know. You're a human being. Mind is present, It can't just be something that you just accept or believe. It is a recognition. You have to recognize something, and we call it recognition, recognize, because it is already present and already known. It's just that you don't know that you know. Nobody's going to teach you anything except hit you on the head and say, look, until you look. The fundamental approach of Zen. You keep observing yourself until perception is crystal clear. So now, ascending to the high seat. Now, in China and Japan, they have these high seats. You climb a ladder and get up there. And I can still picture Tani Roshi in my head. See, that's something human beings can do. They can picture in your head something that isn't even present. Interesting, that, huh? It was present once. So I can still see him sitting up there reading out of this book in his temple Japanese, blah, 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 you know. And then he'd give commentary on it. Laugh! You know, we sat there nagging. 2.5 hours I sat there on that floor. No mat! Just on the floor. Difficult. Ascending to the high seat, Zen Master Hogen, Dogen Zenji. Dogen, as I said, you know, is Zodo Zen. Zen Master Hogen studied with Keishin Zenji. Zenji is another word for Roshi. Zenji, huh? And they asked him, Joseph, where do you go? And Hogen said, I am making pilgrimage aimlessly. The high seat, as we know, is symbolic, you know. It's a way of saying something significant. People have attained knowing are worthy of sitting on a high seat. It's like little Johnny. Or maybe David, little David will get the idea someday. Oh, in this case, Johnny was the son of a local minister. And one day the teacher was asking the class what they wanted to be when they grew up. And when it was Johnny's turn to answer, he replied, I want to be a minister just like my father. And the teacher was very impressed. So she asked him why. Well, he said thoughtfully, since I have to go to church every Sunday anyway, I figure it would be more interesting to be the guy who stands up and yells than the one who has to sit down and listen. See, there's your attitude. Stand up and yell. Right?
Yeah.
In India, the seat from whence the master speaketh is called Vyasa Pitha. It's the seat of the awakened one. The Sanskrit term Vyasa means one who expands or amplifies or interprets or reveals, a revealer. You know, and in the olden days, they used the term, and they gave the word, the name Vyasa, to the highest gurus. You know, so people that like the compiler of the Vedas, he signed it Vyasa. Well, what his real name was, we don't know. But that was the highest guru, see. And the arranger was another Vyasa. And then there was another who did the Mahabharata, out of which comes the Bhagavad Gita, and that probably was another Vyasa, you know. And the last one of any note was the author of the Uttara Mimamsa, which is the sixth school of the six Indian philosophies, Mimamsa. He was also the founder of Vedanta. Yeah? And it is said he lived around 1400 BC, although most people believed that he lived earlier than that. Yeah? The seat of the Buddha, the awakened one. So no one else is allowed to ascend this high seat. But we all sit on a seat, don't we, when we sit for meditation? You think that's any different? This Nishidana? Yeah. Joseph, where are you going? Where do you go, Joseph? This is a way of saying, what is your goal in life? I mean, where are you going? What is your aim? It implies, of course, a few other questions. If you're going someplace, where'd you come from? What is the source of your life? It also implies, you know this, who are you? Joseph, where do you go? And Hogan said, I am making pilgrimage aimlessly. And that's a beautiful answer. If one is going to Mecca, it's not a pilgrimage, it's a trip, you know, with a goal. Or if you're going to Jerusalem, it's not a pilgrimage. There's an aim in it. I'm going to attain enlightenment. That's an aim, see? And where there are aims, there are goals, there is ambition, and where there is ambition, there is desire, and where there is desire, what are you going to do with the ego? Huh? Yeah, automatically. I am making pilgrimage aimlessly. That doesn't mean he was stupid and just wandering around in a circle. You know. It is just a beautiful mundo-like between the master and the disciple. They have this tremendous relationship like that of a caterpillar and a butterfly. Yeah? Where are you going? Well, where life takes me. You do that, don't you? All your plans that you make, and you still, you know, when you're out of college or out of high school, you're going to do this and this and this and this and this. Well, 20 years later, are you any closer to this and this and this and this? Or 40 years later, are you any closer to this and this and this and this? No, you've got this aim, you see. You wander aimlessly. Yeah. Nowhere in particular. You're going to go where life leads, which is what you do. Yeah. It's like a leaf in the wind, huh? Wherever the wind takes you, to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, the north is beautiful. The south is beautiful. The east is beautiful. The west is beautiful. It is all divine. Everywhere there is divinity. Everywhere you go on this aimless pilgrimage, you encounter truth. Moment to moment one lives, making oneself available to truth. If he rises high in the sky, you know, he does not feel superior to the others who are down on the ground. If he falls to the ground, he doesn't feel inferior to others who are rising. He is wandering aimlessly, therefore he cannot fail. A Zen person is victorious even in failure. He has himself. But this master asks again, just to be sure, you know. And Hogan says, now, you know, I don't know. He doesn't repeat the same thing. He's not a parrot, you know. So he says, I don't know. So Kishin, you know, this teacher must have been very, very happy with this student, because he then says to him, not knowing is most intimate. And so Hogan had a great enlightenment. And it was all of a sudden obvious. Now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much for coming out today.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.